Hello and welcome to This Week in Oklahoma Politics. I'm your host, KOSU's Michael Cross, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. The legislature got out a week early, just like the leaders wanted, rather than going to the end of May. Neva, we'll start with you. What did you think of the 2014 session?
Well, it was kind of a rocky roller coaster ride, I think, for most folks out there. A lot of intensity, but really a lot of the big issues, either they got decided in the 11th hour or not decided at all. I think the big winner out of the all of the bills, in my mind, is that the people of Oklahoma, and certainly everyone that comes to the Capitol, works there, or visits, will see, hopefully this fall, some scaffolding and some work beginning on the repairs to the Capitol. And that was one of the big issues that I felt all along. They needed to have the political courage to step up, figure out how to come to some consensus, get the deal done, and they did, and they did it without a vote of the people, which is refreshing because that seemed to be their default idea at the beginning. But I think the $120 million, get it repaired, get it done, I would applaud the lawmakers for that one point alone.
Ryan, what are your thoughts on the election?
I agree with Neva, and they did it in an election year. You know, we shouldn't have to applaud people for keeping the people's building from falling down on their heads while they're going to lobby their legislators on particular issues, but let's face it, you know, the bar for success at the state capitol is pretty low. So, you know, pat them on the back for that, because they did it in election year and they didn't pass the buck along to the people. So that is something to be proud of. But at the end of the day, we passed a quarter of a billion dollar tax cut. We extended a horizontal drilling credit that I'm sure we'll talk about here in a moment. All the while, many state agencies lost funding. You know, we've got combined losses over the last several years of, you know, 20 to 30% for some state agencies. The Oklahoma Healthcare Authority is going to take a huge hit. We're going to see provider reimbursement rates cut, copays increased that are going to hurt vulnerable populations in Oklahoma. And there are other failures as well. There was a lack of any real significant effort on criminal justice reform, an issue that continues to plague our state budget as well as our human resources in the state.
Now, let's talk about some of those bills. In the 11th hour, the Senate killed one of Governor Fallon's signature pieces, HDR 1092, which would have allowed schools to increase their bonding capacity to buy storm shelters. Ryan, were you surprised by this?
Yeah, the storm shelter issue became an unnecessary political football early on in the legislative session. Representative Joe Dorman, who's now a Democratic candidate for governor, who frankly, I don't think would even be a candidate for governor had the governor had Governor Fallon just embraced his storm shelter plan of using the franchise tax to fund a fund for schools to tap into to build storm shelters, instead put out her own alternative plan. That would have only affected 25 school districts, 3% of the 500 school districts in the state that are near their bonding capacity, would have very likely increased property taxes for the schools that opted to build shelters. I'm not surprised that it failed, because it became a political football and less about storm shelters.
Neva, were you surprised by this?
Well, it did become a political football. It was unfortunate, and it became a battle of special interest groups. Let's face it, what happened in the 11th hour in the state Senate was you had basically the ag community versus the education community coming out in full force, trying to be the winner at the end of the session. And I think it also was fascinating among the Republican senators, the mix between the rural and urban senators. I mean, clearly you have a developing kind of scenario among a lot of these lawmakers that you have these different interests and these different pockets of influence, I think, that are historically out there. And I think we saw a really fascinating weigh-in at the last minute and how really the political maneuvering really is what shaped this more than the issue itself. It was which side did they want to come down on? Who did they want to make mad the least? And and when you start talking ad valorem tax increases, you start talking a lot of folks, particularly farmers and others that are, you know, that care and follow what goes on at the Capitol, they seem to weigh in very successfully on this issue.
The Farm Bureau was against this, and that was brought up a lot in the House, but it certainly, and that's usually where you would see a lot of the rural-urban arguments,
right,
but it didn't seem to affect them at all. It was amazing that it actually hit in the Senate, was the one who actually decided to go with that argument.
Yeah, well, you saw it, you know, fail in the House first, and then at the last minute they bring it back up, and then it passes, and then it goes over to the Senate to ultimately die. I mean, it was a really beleaguered process to kill a bill. I just go back to the idea that this could have been avoided – entirely, and we could have really come up with a plan. I think that Governor Fallon's decision to not embrace the initiative petition effort that was going on to put a question on the ballot to fund storm shelters in schools across the state, I think was a political mistake, and it ultimately ended with no funding for storm shelters, at least in the near future. I think we'll ultimately get there.
I think that's right. I think we get there next session. I think they come back and begin to develop some sort of a better consensus model that everyone can live with. I would disagree, though, that the governor has said from the get-go that this is about local control, making these decisions, particularly when we're talking about schools, storm shelters, things that are kind of closest to the folks on the home front, that they need to be the ones making the decision. So I think that got lost somewhere early in the debate when it got ramped up and, as you say, became the political football. I don't think she's a big loser in this, because I think the folks really recognize that they do want those decisions to be made at the local level.
It'll be an issue in the governor's race. I mean, we're gonna hear about this going into the fall, I'm sure.
I think the question is, do the voters really want to hear that much about it, and will they be influenced by that debate?
Right.
Now, one bill which did make it through to the governor's desk was House Bill 3399, which would repeal Common Core. Now, the governor earlier this month vetoed a bill which would have changed her third grade reading retention. Now she's facing a bill to erase the program she helped push through as the chair of the National Governors Association. Neva, will she also veto this bill?
Well, I think everyone says it's a 50-50 question at this point. I think, you know, that it could be very possible that we could see a pocket veto. I mean, that from a timing standpoint, that she basically just lets it die for lack of action. And the thing about a pocket veto versus a veto is she doesn't have to give an explanation. There's no veto message. It just goes away. So, you know, I think it remains to be seen, but that would seem to be, based on what has happened to this point, probably, you know, at least for political observers, you'd have to say that might be a realistic option.
Ryan, what do you think? She'll veto it or sign it? And how do you think it'll affect her election?
I think it's 50-50. I think that, you know, it's going to be very much a political decision on the governor's part as to, you know, who she makes the least angry by a decision here. I've expressed that I've got concerns about Common Core, predominantly with implementation timelines, with the increased reliance on testing. But at the end of the day, if you listen to the debates on the House and the Senate floor, the debates that persuaded the passage of the repeal here weren't about the technical details of Common Core. They're very hyperbolic debates. I think it makes perfect sense, you know, why a lot of these legislators are against Common Core and why they'd be against critical thinking and exposure to a wide range of ideas. It presents an existential threat to their political careers. I get that. But it became this UN conspiracy theory stuff out on the House floor and the Senate floor in a debate of whether you're a Christian or whether you're not a Christian. And that's just ridiculous. It has no place in this debate. Now, there is a provision in this bill that I think gives the governor an easy out if she were going to veto it, and that is that it bypasses the traditional Administrative Procedures Act and would allow the legislature to have a very detailed role in drawing up academic standards that I think is concerning to people on both sides of the aisle. So if the governor vetoes it, don't be surprised if she hangs her hat on the administrative side of it rather than the merits.
Neva, we'd already talked about how the last bill, the storm shelter bill might be coming up in a race. Could this be used in the race if she vetoes or signs it?
It probably will continue to be kind of this rhetoric going back and forth. And I think Ryan's right. I mean, it's really not about the particulars of a bill or about the education kind of framework and all of the points that are contained in this particular legislation. It's really about kind of the overarching theme of, you know, what you're for, what you're against, and these broad brush strokes. I think by and large, the public, again, is not going to really kind of hang their hat on these as being the defining issues that they're going to decide, I'm going to vote for or against this person. It's just going to be part of that kind of overall mix of rhetoric that they're going to see in the political mail and in the advertising.
Governor Fallon did sign House Bill 2562 to increase the tax incentive for horizontal drilling from 1% to 2% for the first 36 months. Oklahoma City Attorney Jerry Fent promised to challenge the bill because it violates State Question 640, which makes it harder to raise taxes. Ryan, does Fent have a case here?
I think Fent does have a case here. And if you look at his track record, Jerry Fent's not somebody who just launches off and files litigation if he doesn't think that he has solid grounds to back it up. So I think that one of the real questions here is if Fint were successful in this lawsuit, you know, it brings into question this whole range of revenue fee increase bills, incentive bills that have been passed over the last two decades. What would happen to that? And I think that there's some judicial remedies that could account for that, but I think that that would be one overarching concern. I think, at the end of the day, if Fint is able to keep this from going into effect, he will have stopped, he will have saved the people of Oklahoma from what I think is one of the most disastrous public policies that that we could have ever enacted this legislative session, which was basically to incentivize activity that's going to occur anyways.
And Eva, do you think Fent's got a case here?
He obviously has the opportunity to take it through the legal course as he's done in the past, and who knows what will happen in that process. I think that the issue of the bill itself, though, to me, what we saw is a very good process and a give and take and a compromise where, folks that were directly impacted and those who, were kind of on all sides of the issues were able to come up with something that really everyone could live with. It was a good, solid compromise. And I think you're talking about both horizontal and vertical drilling. You're talking about something that, has a huge, as I've said before, has a huge impact in terms of an economic factor on the state of Oklahoma. So, I think we can demagogue it to a certain extent, but really this is something that has huge consequences to just regular folks that are out there, either small businesses being affected by the dollars being spent or the folks on the payrolls of these energy companies across the state.
Next week we move into June, and now all eyes turn to the 2014 election. Neva, the primary election takes place just 3 weeks from Tuesday, which is mind-blowing. What are your thoughts on the races to watch?
Well, I mean, obviously, the number one race that's getting the most attention would be the United States Senate race to fill the seat that Dr. Coburn is stepping away from. It will be fascinating to see, I think, whether or not, given the number of folks in that race, whether or not we have a runoff. I think that mm-hmm. seems to be the question of the give and take of the campaign. The level of spending makes it a very, I think a very focused race and one where you would have to expect that it would go to a runoff just given the sheer numbers in the race. But, you hear the kind of back and forth between the campaigns on whether or not someone thinks they can break out and avoid a runoff. That's number one. And I think kind of tied to that is the 5th District Congressional race. Obviously, the seat that James Lankford is leaving to run for the United States Senate. A crowded field, I think a guaranteed runoff. And at this point, I don't think there's really a breakout candidate. I think you've got a lot of folks out there working hard, trying to develop a grassroots campaign, most of them hampered by not a lot of money at this point. So it'll be interesting to see in the final really two-week stretch how much attention they can get and how much advertising they can spend.
Ryan, what are you watching right now?
I think those two races are the marquee races to watch right now. I suspect that if either T.W. Shannon or James Lankford feel that they can break away from the pack and try to win outright without a runoff, you'll begin to see that strategy in the next week or so, unveiling on TV with negative ads. And if they think that they can pull away, they're going to be able to step on the accelerator pretty soon. Otherwise, I think that you'll kind of see this maybe tit for tat and some name recognition ads, and then saving your real ammunition for the runoff race. I'm beginning to see some increase in activity in that 5th District race. I work in Oklahoma City and live in Seminole, so the drive on I-40, I've started to notice more and more billboards. Of course, billboards don't vote, but I saw the big Shane Jett billboard on my way in this morning. And so I think that 5th District race, such a crowded primary, definitely going to be a runoff. If it's not, every political prognosticator in the state's going to be surprised.
I do want to ask about one of the only really big Democratic race is state superintendent. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, four or five people. So how big is that race going to be as we head into the end of June?
Yeah, I think that there again, with so many people in the race, it's very likely that you'll end up with a runoff situation. It's just tough when you've got a crowd of that many people, regardless of having a particular front runner out there. It's tough to get to 50%. Now, of course, if you get there, that's a great obstacle that you've overcome. And so much of that race depends on whether or not the current superintendent, Janet Barisi, is able to survive in her own primary.
Right. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.